Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, we're taking a look at Alien Romulus. The new Alien feature from director Fede Alvarez is out. Excited to talk about it. We went and saw it big. Big screens. All right, it's making a bunch of money this week, and we're going to talk about it. We're also going to talk about Jackpot, the new direct-to-Amazon Prime feature from director Paul Feig of Bridesmaids and The Heat and Spy. He is back with a new comedy starring Awkwafina and John Cena. It's something. It's something we're going to talk about towards the end. Stick around for the review. We're also going to take a look at some upcoming trailers, some stuff you guys want to keep an eye on. And let me tell you, it's getting rough. It's getting rough going into September, October, all right? Things are slowing down. All the summer films are kind of out. We're kind of waiting for the big boom into the winter and holiday seasons. But we got some good picks for you anyway. Stick around for the trailer park. And before we get to all of it, we got to talk about the news. Our first story this week, Nicolas Cage to play NFL icon John Madden in David O. Russell's biopic. That's right, the John Madden movie. Ba-ba-da, ba-ba-da. I think that's football. I'm not a sports guy. I'm a movie guy. But this is exciting. Is that it?
Close. Close enough.
Yes. What do you know about Nick Cage playing John Madden?
So, in yet another kind of eyebrow-raising role for Nick Cage, who is just, I think, one of the bravest actors working today. He will be playing football legend John Madden, who was a very winning coach in the 70s, took the Oakland Raiders to their first Super Bowl victory, went on to do 40 years of color commentary in the NFL before passing away. And this is backed by Amazon and MGM, so that's where we'll see. It'll probably get a theatrical release, I would imagine, but it will eventually end up on Amazon Prime.
I'm excited to see Cage take on a role like this. Like, he often picks, you know, abstract, obscure, surreal performances, especially lately with stuff like Dream Scenario and Long Legs. He's going to just be playing somebody grounded, somebody uniquely grounded, right? Midwest football coach, the face of Madden NFL, the video game series, which is where I would most well know him from. And he's just going to have this big cheesy grin. It's interesting that they were considering Will Ferrell and Hugh Jackman to star in the film before Cage was cast. So it's certainly a unique pick, right? If you're going to have the white-haired, big smile John Madden out and about, why not have it be Nicolas Cage, right? And hey, personally, I'm excited for gray hair Cage. We don't get a lot of that in film. I think he's only done like a couple roles where he has like the full white head of hair, so that'll be something.
He's got to nail the voice. I think that's the most important thing. You know, he doesn't have to be in it exactly the look, especially because John Madden was a big guy, but you got to get the voice right, because that's what was really iconic about him, or became that.
I hilariously don't even know what the man's voice sounds like. Like I said, I saw him on the cover of video games at Blockbuster a lot. That was about where I got the most of John Madden. But I will probably go see Madden the day it comes out. How could I not, right? Like, Cage is a big draw. Great pick. Next story. Mattel wants to make an animated Barbie movie after the live-action film success, which wouldn't be much of a story if not for the fact that Mattel has made dozens of animated Barbie movies. What makes Mattel think that because of the wildly breakout success of adult Barbie, starring Margot Robbie and Ryan Gosling, what makes them think that suddenly an animated feature is gonna make it happen? What's the lightning in the bottle? Andy, what do you got?
It's Illumination, who just can't miss with their animated fare. They're the studio, of course, behind Despicable Me and the Minions franchise, which is a $5 billion franchise, the most successful animated franchise in history. And they, of course, most recently made, not the Barbie movie, the Mario movie, the Super Mario Brothers movie. The first time making that property into a successful film property, which Nintendo had avoided for almost 30 years because the movie that they tried in the 90s was so bad. And so Mattel, I think, deciding to play Pot of Greed here is just seeing dollar signs in there saying, hey, if we can get Barbie to do the Illumination treatment, you know, the Minions treatment, and make it aim it at younger audiences and tap into that Minions audience, we could make $1 billion in animation too, in addition to the film, which is a possibility, but I think it's also a big risk at kind of diluting the brand.
Yeah, I like this bit in here. According to the report from Puck, the key players in the live-action Barbie movie don't seem enthused about this animated version coming to theaters, even though Illumination is lightning in a bottle, right? Like, they seemingly can make any brand work. Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig, producer, star, and writer-director, respectively, of the live-action Barbie movie, don't think this is a good idea, right? Like, might dilute the brand a little bit. Like, they seem to have really introduced something great to the franchise, like, with this live-action version, and maybe they want to make another one or do something with that, but that's only one creative arm of Mattel's Barbie as a whole. Not to mention, Barbie is the highest grossing movie ever for Warner Brothers, according to this report. So yeah, I think between Warner Brothers and Mattel, they both want to make some more money somewhere. But the creatives who kind of put together the most successful iteration may not be on board. I don't know if that's going to hurt their chances, but it may hurt whatever comes next for Barbie in the live action department, whether Margot Robbie's involved or not.
Well, I feel like you needed to make a choice one way or the other to say live action or animation and not try and do both. The other thing is Mattel still owns or retains animation rights, so that Warner Brothers isn't really involved in this at all. So Mattel can kind of do what they want or try to court other studios. I think you risk confusing audiences. They're going to say, oh, is this part of the Barbie movie? Is this like an interconnected universe? It doesn't help that Warner Brothers doesn't really have a follow-up plan to Barbie. Ideally, you would do a sequel just because it was so successful, but I know that the creatives involved don't really want to. So it's, you can't really be upset about someone else taking the property if you're not going to do something with it as well.
Yeah, pretty hilarious to watch Warner Brothers trying to figure this one out. They'll figure it out. They absorb Discovery. They'll get themselves together, I'm sure. From the box office this week, Alien Romulus is absolutely crushing it. Absolutely crushing it. Huge opening. I think they earned their budget back in one weekend, right, Andy? Did I read that right?
Yeah, huge opening weekend. Came in at $110 million globally, $40 million domestic. It cost around $80 million to produce, so we're already in the profit area. Big win for Alien Romulus, and we're going to get more into that movie to talk about why, but it's been a big hit, and it dethroned Deadpool Wolverine, which is now what came in number two at the box office, but is also the number one or the highest grossing rated R movie just past Joker this past week. So a lot of records being broken.
Yeah, I am a little surprised by this, honestly. Like, I've always known Alien to be just kind of this fun franchise that my dad and I used to watch on VHS when my mom is out of town. But it turns out males all over the country are going to see Romulus. It's turning out in droves all over the world, really. I guess their big claim right now is that they dethroned Deadpool, right? Like, they managed to knock Deadpool out of the number one spot. And it's a big W for Disney, right? Disney owns Alien now since they acquired 20th Century Fox. It turns out, like, although they're working on X-Men, they've got a few other properties that are turning out successes for them, much like Alien Romulus. Seems all but inevitable we're getting another one of these in some capacity. I don't know what kind of runway it's going to have while it's still in theaters. Movies don't do this good and not get some kind of sequel from Hollywood, right? Like, they learn all the wrong lessons over there. The Bean Counters will demand another Alien Remus or something like that, right, Andy?
Yeah, absolutely. You don't do these kinds of numbers and not do more. Also, it's just, we'll get into more. These movies always kind of set up more for more sequels, and there's lots of kind of time gaps where you could go in there. We're definitely going to be getting more of these, I think.
Yeah. Not to mention, I apologize. I was right in between articles. Did you mention that Deadpool and Wolverine is the top grossing R-rated pick of all time?
Because
we're going to talk about that.
Yes.
Dude, huge. Like, I never would have thought Deadpool 3 was going to kill it, but apparently here we are. I also infamously thought Inside Out 2 was not going to be a huge hit, and now that's like the 10th highest grossing film of all time. So I'm starting to worry. I can't call him anymore, Andy. I'm starting to get a little concerned.
I mean, honestly, I still don't understand the success of Inside Out 2. I thought it was fine. I don't know why people are continuing to see it so much, but I'm glad for Pixar to have a win because they have struggled. Also, number three at the box office was It Ends With Us, the Blake Lively domestic violence movie, which a lot of people don't know it's about domestic violence, apparently, but that's clearing on nearly $200 million on a like $30 million budget, so that's already a huge success. Twister's showing back up in the number four slot, which is funny because it's available on video on demand. And then what is probably the big surprise and embarrassment is that the re-release of Coraline surpassed Borderlands. It came in at 10 million, where Borderlands in its second weekend made just two, and in a very embarrassing, that might be the worst bomb of the year, really.
Borderlands may actually turn out to be the biggest bomb of the year. I think over $100 million budget, and like they barely made what, 15 back over the last 2 weeks. One of the biggest drop-offs from week one to week two in all of movies in 2024. And yeah, getting beat out by the Coraline re-release is particularly funny because Coraline did good when it re-released last year, and I went and saw it and did a mini review on this show. Like I already went and saw the Coraline re-release. Not only is this like the second re-release, this is I think their third or fourth time Leica has put that movie back in theaters. It's like its 15th anniversary, by the way.
Yeah, it's pretty old.
Great movie.
It's a classic.
Would recommend. Ton of fun to watch in theaters. I did like it, but nobody seems to be turning out for Borderlands. I mean, like, it can't even get word of mouth, right? Like, even the people who go see it say it's so bad, it's bad, it's worse than Madame Web kind of stuff, you know? Like, really rough around the edges over there.
Yeah. Also, from what I haven't played Borderlands, but everyone tells me this movie is 10 years too late. Like, the game was a lot bigger and it hit about a decade ago, and so we're way too late. Ironically, another Borderlands game was announced today, Borderlands 4, I believe. So maybe they're trying to brush it, the movie under the rug.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what they're doing. Gearbox, who makes Borderlands, knows that it's not exactly a big hit. Eli Roth got off the Borderlands set, immediately shot and released Thanksgiving, which came out before Borderlands. It's been in kind of development hell for a while. They had to get it out in theaters. They knew it was a big bomb. It is what it is, man. I did read something about Lionsgate, like, licensing overseas rights, like, to distributors internationally, and they made a bunch of money doing that, but I think those distributors are going to be pissed because they're realizing that they got a big dud on their hands, so more on Borderlands next week, I think, on Offscript Film Review. We'll return to this monstrosity, but for now, we got to talk about real monsters, the ones in space. I'm excited to talk about this movie. Like I said at the news section, I used to watch these movies with my pops, so it was really cool going to see this one. I will be taking the summary on this, so please excuse my clumsy delivery. The movie is Alien Romulus. So, Alien Romulus is uniquely set between the events of Alien and Aliens. If you're a new Alien fan, the quick rundown is Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, a couple of those Alien versus Predator movies, Prometheus, and then Alien Covenant. Last two, most recently, were original director Ridley Scott. This is from Fede Alvarez, newcomer to the franchise, but not a newcomer to horror. He is the director of Evil Dead 2013. A lot of fun, that movie, and Don't Breathe, which did real well. I remember when that came out in theaters. Alien Romulus is the story of Rain and Andy, two space colonizers working on a Weyland-Yutani colony where things have not quite been terraformed to their liking yet, and they really want to escape this awful hellscape they live and work in and get to a planet 9 light years away with sunlight and fields and grass where things are good, a paradise. But they can't do it. They're trapped. And when they find out one day from their friends Tyler, Kay, Bjorn, and Navarro that there's a derelict space station up in orbit that they discovered before anybody else on the colony has figured it out. And that's when the six of them hop in their little spacecraft, fly up to Romulus. This derelict space station just seems to be floating in orbit just above the asteroid ring, where it may be impacting in 36 hours or so. And upon boarding the space station to look for hyperpods so they can, or cryopods, so they can get into light sleep and go to where they need to go, that is when they discover some horrors of alien origin. It is, of course, set between the events of Alien and Aliens. Like I said at the top, Sigourney Weaver's character Ripley is supposed to be in hypersleep on the other side of the universe. We don't need to worry about any of that. What we do have to worry about is escaping alive in Alien Romulus. Andy, what'd you think?
So I really enjoyed this, and I'm a big Alien fan, and I kind of saw these movies out of order, which is funny. My very first Alien movie to see was Prometheus, which I really like, and that was back when everyone kind of hated it, and then I kind of went back and saw the rest of the film, so it took me a while to really get the entire franchise, but I thought this was really great. I particularly like the first act, which is all the setup, which a lot of times in a movie like this would be very slow and kind of boring, and you'd be waiting to get, let me just get to the action. But I was really invested in our characters from the beginning and their plight of like, we got to get off this mining colony. This is our plan. These are different character motivations. We're introduced to our small crew who we know are probably doomed or mostly doomed, which is a lot of fun. And then we do kind of play the hits of the Alien franchises, but I enjoyed that. A lot of people, I don't know, you can't please fans, because when Ridley Scott did something different with Prometheus and Alien Covenant, people were like, well, we wanted to see more, you know, traditional Alien stuff. And so then now we get a movie that has more of that, and everyone's like, well, why didn't you do anything different? But no, I enjoyed this all the way through. I thought there was a lot of good action, the effects, like the settings, like there was a lot of bragging by the production about how they built a lot of these sets, and they feel very tactile. A lot of good mood, a lot of good action. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, I had a great time with Alien Romulus, which is funny because leading up to it, I started seeing like, you know, inklings of Twitter reviews that were pretty negative. People were pretty harsh on Alien Romulus going into it. And I was really surprised people coming out and be like, oh my God, it's the biggest bomb of the year. I can't believe it. Nobody saw it coming. And I was thinking like, are they just exaggerating? What do they mean? And I went and saw it and had a great time. I think Alien Romulus is a lot of fun. I don't know what people were expecting. I do think, having seen all these movies, it is a very clever plucking of the best parts from like six different Alien films. But my God, what do you people want at the summer box office? Like, how is that not working? It has great effects. I love the look of the movie. The cinematography is stunning. And when it needs to go to 11, it pushes the amp all the way to 12. It's fun. It's serious. It's wacky. It's Alien Romulus, dude. Like, God, people take movies too seriously, I think. So I'm excited to talk about it because I think this movie is a multitude of different, like I said, the best parts of Alien movies. And it's important to mention at this point, we don't do spoilers on Oscar Film Review, so we're not going to spoil anything for you. We'll talk around things where we can, and we'll keep it tidy because we got some trailers to talk about, and we got to talk about, boy, my brain just walked right off a cliff.
Jackpot.
I knew where I was going with that. Jackpot. Yes, the most memorable film of 2024. So for Alien Romulus, I want to start with the look of the world. I think that's the best thing. Boy, Fede Alvarez has got a good set designer. And I think they used a lot of the original talent from the Alien series. I remember them talking about plucking a CGI director from here and somebody from here. And I don't have exactly their credentials on those. But man, the look of Alien Romulus is so fantastic. The technology is this like 80s CRT flashing light and blinking knob covered screens and panels that all look so kinetic. And on top of that, like incredible lighting down big hallways, right? Like this is something Fede Alvarez is really exceptional in, like capturing practical sets, physical effects, updating with CGI where we can, and most importantly, filling out with really, really incredible sound design that I think nobody's talking about. Not enough. This is one of the best sounding movies I've seen all year. It's really, really fantastic. The look of Alien Romulus is top class. Like, no complaints. I think it is a really great looking movie.
Yeah, that's what this franchise is kind of known for, is creating these very convincing environments where you have these kind of dirty, derelict ships. Because I saw this great essay that said Alien is kind of the opposite of a lot of space movies where space is defined as man's highest achievement. Like we're navigating the stars and look how complex our technology is. And in the Alien universe, it's kind of different where it's like, yes, we are doing those things, but everyone's kind of an indentured servant and it's real grimy and everyone's just struggling to get by. And that's how the world and the ships feel. Like they're big, they're dank, they're dark, it's complicated, but you still have, you know, space flight and that kind of thing. And all the science stuff looks real, real convincing. All the, you know, the different rooms, we got a lot of fun, just different things going on. There's a section where we have the gravity in the ship is kind of, it's like the gravity generator has to be like recharged or rebooted. And so that your gravity kind of goes in and out a couple of times, which is a fun section. So it's all that just works so well. They do such a good job of really convincing you of this universe and this world.
Yeah, it's great setting for our cast, who is small but mighty, I think, where they need to be. We've got functionally six people, Rain and Andy, played by Kaylee Spaney and David Johnson, who are functionally our protagonists. Rain is a young colonizer. Andy is her android, kind of assigned brother by her father, who's kind of out of the picture. Andy is not a high-functioning android. He's got some kind of problems. He is maliciously made fun of. Nobody respects him. They do not think of him as any kind of real being because he's a synth, right? He's a synthetic. Actually, great setup for one of our other characters, Bjorn, who's just kind of a dick to Andy all the time, which is good because you start to not like him and you know he's going to be alien fodder at some point because that's how these movies work. Tyler and Kay and Bjorn and Navarro make up the rest of the crew, these other colonizers who tell Rain and Andy about their plan to go up to this derelict space station, steal some cryopods, and hit the road for their desired planet 9 light years away. They're all great. Like, they're all simple. They all have unique silhouettes. They don't look like one another. They sound different. They're all charismatic in their own ways. Bjorn is mean. Tyler is a leader. Kay is kind of a follower background character with her own history, and Navarro is their fearless pilot, buzz cut, shaved head. Like, the six of them are small and mighty, and they work great for what they're supposed to be. Like, they're grungy, their costume design's fine, and you know going into it that they're obviously going to be running into some problems. Small crew plus alien movie does not usually mean good things for crew, but I think the movie does a good job of, like, earning its kills where it needs to. You know what I mean? Like, they're juicy and gory and bloody and satisfying in a way that I don't think hurts the picture at all. I think it's classic alien stuff. I was very pleased with it.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to get into our cast a little bit here. Really surprising breakout from David Johnson, who plays the android Andy. Because he is a decommissioned android that's been saved by Rain's father, and he's, funny enough, he's been programmed to protect her but also tell dad jokes. But he, at first, I thought he was just someone who was, like, slow or disabled, and then it's kind of very quickly revealed that he's a synthetic. But he also kind of gets the joy of playing two characters, because he gets a kind of an upgrade early in the film, where his whole personality shifts, and so it's a really fun time. But that performance is one of the best in the film, generally. And our whole crew is a lot of fun. Kaylee Spaney, who initially I thought she's kind of backseated in the first half of the movie, and then she's definitely the forefront the rest of the time. But at first I was like, when are we going to get more of her? And then, of course, Isabella Merced, who famously played Dora the Explorer, which is funny. She really goes through this movie. She's doing her best to survive. And then everyone else is a little bit forgettable, but we do have our classic cast of doomed characters. It'll be interesting trying to guess who will and won't survive.
Yeah, and let's talk about that survival. We got to talk about the aliens, right? The look of them, the feel of them, the sound of them. Aliens are good stuff in this movie. I can comfortably say that the movie, I think, leans more aliens than it does Alien. Alien has one alien with our group of space truckers on the Nostromo. Aliens has a few, which is functionally where we're at. There's more than one being to worry about. A, you got your traditional face huggers, of which, if you've seen the trailer or you're watching our live stream where you can see right now, a lot of face huggers. And a lot of face huggers leads to usually a lot of aliens. That's traditionally how it goes, right? This movie does take some liberties, I think, in things like gestation period, how long it takes between when a face hugger grabs onto your face and implants an egg into you to when it turns into the thing that bursts out. And then when that thing goes from, like, a small thing to a big thing, admittedly, it does make some leaps, I think. But otherwise, like, that gives us a lot of opportunities for hilariously gross practical effects, wildly sexual, hugely uncomfortable, hilarious. I was so into it, dude. Like, the slime and the gross things that totally look like genitalia, like, way too much. And all of that's a lot of fun when people start, you know, bleeding and getting murdered and dying. And you combine all of that with not only good effects, like we talked about in the look of the film, and but also tools that our characters use. In the trailer, you'll see one character has, like, this X-ray like scanner thing that they put against their back so you can see through their chest and you can see the thing wiggling around in them, which is just great. And then there's another sequence with a gun that has an auto fire, like auto aim ability, and they really show you exactly how it works on the screen. The gun turns, you can't miss. Like little touches like that, a lot like Blade Runner, like help fill out the world. It feels like a real, full, natural world that people are in because they're using tools that are fitting of the setting to fight against the very thing they're trying to get away from. Like, rock solid. Tons of fun, dude.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of touch on that. This movie does a good job of dealing with tension, both in different situations where you have to, you know, try to sneak by and not get noticed, but also things like you might have to choose who's going to live and who's going to die because you can, maybe you can't save everyone. And so then you have to pick who's going to survive. And one of the things that I loved about the pulse rifle, we see it in the trailer. And when we get to the movie, it really teases to us quite a bit because we see it, people get their hands on it, we learn how it works. But it's a while until it finally goes off. But when it does, it's very satisfying. But it's a great exercise in tension because you're just waiting for that thing to unload.
Yeah. And I think to talk about the negative of the feature, like again, we're not spoilers here, so we won't get too into it. But I think the movie does have issues with pacing that people don't like. Mainly, not that things don't happen, because it's a fast 2 hours. I think this movie actually is paced really well. But that it's got some wacky elements that feel out of place for what it is. It starts slow and it's small crew, but then they go up to the space station and there's more than one creature. And then they find an antagonist kind of character that is wildly divisive that we can't really talk about on this show because it'd be spoilery, but that's odd. And then people have talked about how the third act gets real crazy. It's not really the third act. It's really like the last 20 minutes of the movie. But for what it's worth, I genuinely had a good time watching that stuff. I was like big grin in the theater. I was like, this is great, dude. Like, this is something I didn't expect. I didn't see this coming. It's a fun summer blockbuster. Like, and I think Alien Romulus knocks it out of the park. At least at the box office, it looks like it does. So I'm just surprised to see people be like, oh, it's bad. I don't know. Andy, did these things knock you off? Were you not into this?
I was totally into it. I know that it's it's doing things that we've seen before. It is playing the hits. But man, I was in my theater. There's a moment where a kind of classic callback line happens and my theater ate it up. People were yelling, clapping. I mean, the majority of people are loving it. And the box office reflects that, you know, if people didn't like those things, it wouldn't be doing near as well as it is. The fact that it is shows the majority of people not on film Twitter are really enjoying it.
Yeah. Not only did I enjoy Alien Romulus, I'm looking forward to what is likely coming next. Because like we talked about in the news, this movie has made its budget back already. It is almost guaranteed to be getting some sort of sequel or follow-up, whether that keeps these characters or moves somewhere else. You're going to have to go watch the movie and find out. But it's a good time. Yeah, like I'm with Andy. Like people in my theater were eating up the cheesy lines. There is a jump scare towards the end of this feature that got one guy in the front row in front of me so good. I got to see him in the dark, full up, popcorn goes up in the air. It was the best jump scare I've seen all year. Like, it's a great time. It's a great time. And I feel odd reading reviews that people didn't really get into it because, man, I had so much fun watching it. Any other thoughts or recommendations, Andy?
I think I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend Alien Romulus?
Yeah, I absolutely would. I thought it was a lot of fun. It is scary. It does have scary moments, but it's more than that. It's the feel. We have good characters. We have a lot of our kind of classic Alien moments that we've come to know and love. And it's a fun ride. It is playing the hits, no doubt, but it's a good time all the way through, and it's definitely setting up for some more films that I'll definitely be excited to be there. So highly recommend.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. Like, Alien Romulus is a lot of fun. Don't go in expecting too much. It's like a greatest hits concert in the best way. Like, tons of fun. Remixes the best parts of the franchise. Admittedly, goes too far in some places. But also, like, I think that can be a good time in its own right, right? Like, I think Alien Romulus is a lot of fun. I would recommend go see it in a theater. Go see it big. Go see it loud. I saw it in a Dolby theater. My seat was shaking when the ship was taken off at the beginning. It rocked, dude. Totally go see Alien Romulus. And with that, we should move into some trailers, some upcoming stuff that we want to talk about this holiday season. I'm excited to get into it. Andy, you mind introducing this for us?
It's time for the trailer park. So we got three trailers coming at you this week. The first is for, we got the full trailer for The Substance, which is a new horror movie coming out September 20th, starring Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley. Demi Moore plays an aging Hollywood star, which she kind of is in real life. She's in her 60s, and she discovers this wonder drug that will basically revert her to like the body of a 20-year-old, played by Margaret Qualley. Of course, this comes at a high price, because it's not like exactly legal, and this is this big body horror movie that we've heard a lot from. It won for best screenplay. I'm super excited about this. We got to see just more of this kind of movie. The style is real wild. Some of it reminded me of Greener Grass, which we watched a couple of years ago, where the Margaret Qualley scenes are like this big and bright, and she's so young and thin and vibrant, and it's, you know, it's gonna come at a price. And I really love the look of this film, and I can't wait for it.
Dude, like fisheye lenses, freakish saturation, weird Dennis Quaid with food on his mouth. Dude, I can't wait to watch The Substance. This movie looks so freak and weird. It's going to be rad. Qualley continues to turn out and turn out great work. Demi Moore is going to be great. And again, like I low key cannot wait to watch Dennis Quaid playing like a weird actor role again. You know what I mean? And not just some like preachy thing that he's been into lately. Like, big fan. I think this movie's going to rock. We also got to talk about the trailer for Azrael. This is an odd one. This is a Shudder picture, right? We most recently watched Late Night with the Devil from them. Also Skinamarink. Lots of fun. Azrael stars Samara Weaving as a... I'm going to say a prisoner, right? As far as I can tell, out in the woods.
A sacrifice.
When a devout religious group has captured her and is sacrificing her to some kind of beast in the woods. Notably, a group that does not speak, according to the trailer. No dialogue included in here. Mute. But our final girl is not so final, and upon escaping, realizes she will do whatever she can to fight back and get away from this freak cult and their freak monsters. Bit of a monster feature, bit of a blood and gore, and like I said, Samara Weaving, from Ready or Not, in the lead. Andy, what do you think?
Well, it was interesting because I had another trailer on here, which I took off to put this one on. I really like the look of this. Again, it's kind of this grounded feel that we're out in the woods. There's this creepy mute cult. There's some sort of something that they're sacrificing people to. This does look like a movie that doesn't have any dialogue. It's one of those, especially with the muted cult. I kind of hope there's more, but love Samara Weaving. She was also in Babylon. She plays the foil to... Margot Robbie's Nelly LeRoy. That's right. She's always fabulous, and she needs more work. And this is a little film I'm happy to support. Also, Azrael means it's like Angel of Death in Arabic or something like that.
Oh, I didn't know that. No, I also want to come out pro Samara Weaving. She totally gets shafted in Scream 7 by being like the early Drew Barrymore character. And then she gets shafted in Babylon by being the woman that gets replaced by Margot Robbie, the newer, hotter, younger talent. She's got to get back in leading role status. Like, she's great in Ready or Not. She's great in both of those small roles. Like, I'm very much looking forward to her getting her own project again. I will probably check out Azrael. God, I hope it's not a no dialogue movie though, dude. I get so bored. Yeah. It's such a tough gimmick, man. Such a tough gimmick.
Also, that's her character's her character's name is Azrael, so it's not some other person. So that's an interesting touch as well. Yeah, I'm definitely interested to see where that goes. There's got to be more dialogue because it's tough. What was the Caitlin Dever movie that had no dialogue?
I can't remember this movie. We were talking about this earlier. Well, let me look it up. We watched it on the show, which is terrible.
But anytime there's a movie like that with zero dialogue, it's a struggle. It's a real struggle. While you're looking that up, I'll
no
talk.
No One Will Save You was Caitlin Dever movie on Hulu. God, we covered it on the show.
Alien movie.
Yeah. terrible.
Next movie up, this just came out today, a new horror action disaster comedy called Y2K. Those of us who are old enough will remember Y2K was a big kind of scare they had in 1999. There was fear that when the year turned over into the year 2000, that like computers would break, electronics would stop working, and all this sort of thing. So this movie kind of takes that premise seriously, where there's kind of a senior end of year party that stars Jaden Martell and Rachel Zegler, and they're at this party. Y2K happens, midnight rolls around, and everything does, like, the power goes out, all the electronics stop working. But not only that, the electronics become like sentient things, and they start killing people. So then it becomes a survival movie as well as kind of a coming of age thing. This comes out in December. Kind of a wacky premise. Looks like it maybe have done better on streaming, but what do you think, Zach?
So Kyle Mooney is a big talent at SNL, and he was putting out great content before he ever joined SNL, like on his YouTube channel. I would be looking forward to watching a Kyle Mooney written feature, and even directed, which is what he's handling here. He also stars in this film as a small role character named Garrett. You can see him in the trailer. And I think like a lot of the practical effects of this movie look good, like the odd kind of animatronic monsters, a bunch of wires and motherboards and keyboards and Tamagotchis and all kinds of stuff rigged up to attack these like young high schoolers who are like, oh, the Y2K bug is real. But like, it's such a rote premise. Like the Y2K bug, that was a quarter of a century ago. Like, are we really making this movie? Like, maybe it'll be fire. Like, maybe I'm over here, I don't know what I'm saying, but like, it just seems fine. And I think the legs of the movie are going to have to be in the script. If Mooney's written something particularly hilarious, this will work. But the trailer's not that funny. This trailer's more like action concept and is not actually like that funny. So I don't know. We're gonna have to see what happens, shakes out of Y2K, I guess. And it's produced by Jonah Hill, so that's good. That's some talent there.
It's very, very millennial coded. Like I said, a lot of media is aimed at millennials right now because they're the kind of largest population group. And this is filled with nostalgia. I kind of turned to dust a little when someone pointed out that Rachel Zegler wasn't even born when Y2K happened. Might remind you of things like This Is the End, the kind of stoner boner comedy starring Seth Rogen and Michael Cera from the 2010s. This is kind of in that vein, but it just doesn't look near as kind of edgy and funny. It's got a little bit of Superbad in there as well. I feel like this movie gets made every like 10 to 12 years. It's kind of coming of age, last night of high school, got to get the girl kind of thing. I need to see more because it looks like it could be it should be a straight to streaming film, or it could be really funny.
Right, like good talent at the front, good script writer. We'll see. It's good if the jokes are good. If it holds up, it'll be a good time. Hey, speaking of good jokes, we got one more movie to talk about. We should probably get to it. You're gonna be taking the summary on this one. Please, Andy, take it away.
Jackpot. So this is the latest action comedy from director Paul Feig, who's previously known for things like Freaks and Geeks, Spy, Heavyweights, those sorts of things. I'm trying to think of what his most recent one was. Anyways,
Bridesmaids, The Heat, Spy with Melissa McCarthy.
There we go. So you know, he's a funny guy. He's made some really great comedies. This stars Awkwafina as Katie Kim, who's recently moved to the future Los Angeles. Is taking place in like 2030. She's a struggling actor. She's trying to become one. Not having a good time. She's got to rent this sleazy Airbnb. She's getting kind of nickel and dimed at every moment. When she accidentally wins the lottery, except now there is this lottery that is kind of across from the Purge movies, where if someone manages to kill you kind of with their bare hands, they can take your ticket and claim the prize. And so the lottery is a ridiculous number. It's like $3.5 billion. Katie Kim wins. And now everyone in LA is trying to kill her. She's running. She runs into John Cena's character, who is a freelance protector. He's like, hey, give me a cut of the winnings and I'll protect you through this thing. And so that's a setup for comedy, but also lots of action as they fight off all these goons and other other people trying to get the tickets. Simu Liu is in this also as a, who's got his own protection agency. There's some things that work about this. There's a lot of this that just screams like streaming movie, but we'll get into it. Zach, what'd you think?
So I'm not a big Paul Feig fan, admittedly. I think some of his earlier work worked not bad. I remember seeing Bridesmaids in theaters and thinking it was really great and looking forward to looking at other stuff he'd done. I remember watching episodes of The Office that he'd put together. So he did some Parks and Rec, lots of fun. He did a couple of Melissa McCarthy movies that, you know, did fine, I think, in their own right. But then since he's kind of shifted back to TV, doing small stuff, he did a film in 2022 for Netflix called The School of Good and Evil that I don't recall ever seeing. So I didn't really know what to expect out of this, but I knew there's some talent at the front, right? Awkwafina, John Cena, Simu Liu, a lot of fun. I like all of those people. They all make good stuff. The premise seems all right. We'll see. And I'm not, I guess, sore to say the jackpot did not do it for me, man. Like, it's just not that funny. That's kind of it on its primary face, is it's kind of a joke-a-minute feature, and there's few jokes that land. There's a few. I did laugh a couple times, but it just kind of still has that lingering, like, almost Judd Apatow style of comedy that Feig seems to be leaning into in his last few years. Which is show up with the script and then have the actors do the scene, but they'll improv in it and they'll riff and they'll say a couple like glib lines that they come up with on the day, and then we'll just pick the best stuff in editing and put it in the movie. And it doesn't work that good, dude. Like, it didn't work that good on your last couple movies, and like I don't think it's working that good here. And I don't have a lot of hard evidence to say that's what's happening, but I do know there's a lot of throwaway lines, and I do know that the writer, Rob Yescombe, traditionally does video games. He doesn't do a lot of screenplays for movies, and most of his video games are like sci-fi action. There's a couple of them are like dystopian future, and it leads me to wonder if like Jackpot maybe originally started as a more serious kind of script and then just got picked up along the way and shaped and kind of rolled into this kind of comedy that we've got here on Amazon. It's lightweight, sure, but it's also like 2 hours. And when you're looking to watch something at home, you know, that can be, it can be quite a lot of time to not laugh at a movie. So Andy, what did you think of Jackpot?
It definitely did not quite pass the 6 laugh test. I was counting. There are a lot of attempts at jokes that, yeah, it's just not that funny. I think my biggest thing was that it looks like the entire movie is shot on back lots and, you know, sound stages. Like, it never looks like they're ever on an actual street or in a real building. Also, I needed the action to just be more and better. And I'm sure they use a lot of stunt people, but, you know, there's a time where, you know, Jackie Chan, this would have been a Jackie Chan movie and he would have done all his own stunts and they would have been incredible and amazing. And he, you know, would have broken a bone or two to get there. And we don't really get that. And it's a shame because, you know, Simu Liu is an action star. John Cena is large, like capable of doing action as well. And he does a fair amount, but he's actually the funnier part of this. Like, I know that Awkwafina is known as like the comedian, but John Cena is like way funnier than her in this movie. I felt it definitely needed to tighten up the script. This is a 80 to 90 minute idea tops. Yeah, you needed more to make this more cinematic, and it's definitely like, oh, this is just going on streaming. It's just kind of whatever.
Yeah, it starts with like a wildly cynical premise. The movie opens with like this, like, I think straight RoboCop inspired like technology font, like it's 2030 in Los Angeles and there's this big lottery. We were talking about before the show, Andy compared it to Purge. Great comparison, right? There's one day a year when somebody gets selected, and if you can murk them first, then you get the money. The movie is, then it does this big like stamp in thing, Jackpot, and I swear it looks like the RoboCop font. It's the oddest thing. And then we get our like future Los Angeles where like everybody's mean and no one's nice to each other. And Awkwafina is this well-meaning woman from Michigan. I think she's where she was staying with her mom. And now she's back in California because she wants to become an actress, and she gets like the worst Airbnb in the world and no one's nice to her and everybody takes advantage of her. And like it's nothing is working out for Awkwafina because LA is just this like hellscape of actors and actresses looking for opportunities, until of course she whips out this like odd little card screen she's got that everybody has that's like branded the grand lottery, and it's like, you won, because I don't know why they just weren't on phones. I don't know if they didn't want to just like have iPhones and Androids on set where people have to whip them out and look at their cell phones. They've got these like prop cards. And then everything goes to hell in a handbasket, right? Like she's running from people and jumping out of the way and saying glib lines like they didn't teach us that at fight school. Like, and it like stuff that's not doesn't really land until, like you said, Cena shows up. Simu Liu starts to get rolled in the picture. You start to get some more talent behind a challenging premise, I think. And that's where the movie, say, Act Two, I guess, has got the bulk of the goods. That's where most of the good stuff happens.
Yeah, we get a handful of action classic things. We got car chases, we got fisticuffs, we got there's a strange rule where you can't actually use any guns to try to kill the lottery person, so there's no like guns, firearms, so there's no shootouts. It's just all melee weapons basically, and a lot of car chases. I think strangely also in the script they try to give them both like really tragic backstories out of nowhere, and it seems really really out of place because it's like a silly action comedy, and then there's like, man, you know, when that operation went wrong in Afghanistan and I had to leave everyone behind, and it still haunts me to this day. And I was just like, Jesus Christ, what are we doing here, man? It's a little bit lighten up, kids.
Yeah, well, like I said, like between the cynical premise and the everybody's getting rammed backstories and like the techno font at the top and the dystopic, like there's even a RoboCop joke in the script. I was like, is this supposed to be like a low key Paul Verhoeven riff of like an alternate future where people are just taking advantage of the lottery? Because again, looking at the writer, Rob Yescom, it would imply that it is. And then just somewhere along the way, it got rolled into like this comedy, like lighthearted action thing. Cause the script doesn't point to it being that all that lighthearted. Like that comes from the improv and the presentation, the bright colors, the set design, which is all fine, save for A, the wire rig that they use in every action scene to either like flip some stunt guy over in the background, some eccentric fashion, or for one of the big fight scenes towards the end involves a lot of wire rigging, and B, all of the many interior car shots that are all shot in like the same interior car with the same lighting, and they just green screen like the windows in. There's a ton of car footage in this movie for no reason. Lots of conversations in cars for some reason. Like, I mean, I guess we're on the run. I guess that's what we're working towards. But like, it's chunky, and it's very obviously like straight to streaming. We're not overthinking it. We're just making a movie. That's the pitch here.
Yeah, but it was, I struggled to get through this. I had to watch it in two parts because I just couldn't bring myself to sit through the last half hour all in one go. I had to get, like, come back to it the second day. Machine Gun Kelly is surprisingly in this for no reason. There's a couple of cameos where they're just like, hey, you know, if we give you an extra $100, can you show up on set for? And that's what these streaming movies do. They spend a lot of money on stars and cheap out on everything else to just get this out there. And it kind of works because it's, you know, it is famous faces on here, but everything else looks so cheap. I mean, it looks cheaper than a TV movie, which I have happened to, my mom was watching a TV a Lifetime movie when I start, like right before I started this, and I was like, the Lifetime movie is more convincing than the sets and all the setup for all this.
Yeah, it bums me out a little bit whenever I see a movie like Jackpot like at the top of like the front page of Amazon or Netflix, like, new, watch our new straight to streaming movie with John Cena, Awkwafina. And then people click on it and watch it, and they're like, that's okay. You know, like, we can do better than okay, you know? And I think Amazon can do better than okay, but you're right. Like, it's movie by algorithm, right? It's, we know how much money we think this will make. We know what we think we'll get from these stars. Let's get these people in it and this director and this script, and boom, you got your movie, right? Like, you're on your way. Jackpot will be hot for 2 weeks and nobody will ever watch it again. Like, it feels like it's like a Walmart DVD bin movie, right? It's like you'd find this in a Redbox a decade ago and you'd look at it and be like, what's that? And then just not ever get it. Maybe see the trailer someday on YouTube. But Jackpot is just out there for the world to see. And it's like laughably misses the mark. It's not funny. It's not clever. It doesn't have, I feel like it kind of tries to say something about the state of Los Angeles. Like, maybe there's a bit of that in joke stuff that Feig's slipping in. Like, it's just ruthless out here. You know, there's an audition scene that's like particularly cruel. Awkwafina's got a line at the end about YouTubers and wrestlers becoming famous, which is where her and Cena respectively started. Like, I kind of get that, but like in the 2 hours that it is, like, nobody's going to get to the end of that rainbow, man. Like, it's just too boring. Like, it just doesn't get there fast enough.
Yeah, I was actually more invested at the very beginning when she first moves to LA and she's like, she's losing money hand over fist because it's like, oh, she gets signs into the Airbnb and it's like a tiny closet and like the ceiling's leaking. And then she shows up to the audition and that's a real, like, that was more interesting, like her trying to make it as an actor than the entire premise of this whole lottery thing. And they're, you know, in the end, it's about the value of friendship, not the value of money. A lot of cliches, stuff like that. Yeah, it's fine. It's one of these, like, put it on the background while you're doing your laundry, doing chores, like, look up every now and then. Not as much.
Yeah, not long ago, I rewatched Paul King's Wonka from last Christmas. And that movie opens with Timothée Chalamet as young Wonka, like, arriving to town, and he sings this 12 Silver Sovereigns song, and over the course of the song, he loses all of his money because everybody in town takes advantage of him, and he's some outsider, and, like, it's charming and sympathetic, and it gets you to where you need to go in, like, the 3 minutes that song is, and then you get, like, a couple more finagling, and we're off, like, we're on the way to the movie, and this movie takes, like, 25 minutes to get going, and it's like, oh, boy. There is, admittedly, an opening montage featuring Sean William Scott of American Pie fame that is mildly fun and really just, like, makes me wish I was watching that movie instead of Jackpot, right? Like, that would have been, I think, a little bit more intriguing, but I appreciate that they stuck it in there as some kind of action starter, because without it, my God, it's a dry 20. Like, I bet there's two versions of this movie that doesn't have that montage and one that does, and the audience retention time with that in there is notably higher than it just starting probably flat, yeah, like nothing going on, you know. I yeah,
like, anyway. I said, it really reminded me of those old older Jackie Chan films, like Rumble in the Bronx, or kind of all those films he did where he did his own, like, really crazy stunts, and it was just, like, incredible to see. And also in like Hong Kong cinema, like, you were expected to do those stunts. You're like, no, you're not using a stunt, man. Like, Jet Li was the same way. He's doing all his own stunts, and it reminded me of that kind of movie, which we don't really get anymore, but it's just kind of a watered down version of it.
Yeah, and that's a good comparison too, because Chan often had, like, those kind of, like, fish out of water protagonist roles where he'd be like, why are you doing this to me? Like, I'm just trying to go about my day, right? And people are just attacking him out of nowhere. And Awkwafina's got that. And it's a clever bit to have Cena step in and be her, like, just take all the bullets kind of character, right? He's the one getting whacked with the bat. He's the one getting a fluorescent light bulb broken over his head. Like, that all sounds great on paper, but it doesn't work because I don't think they wrote a lot of it down. Like, I think they just expected it to come to him on the day, and they were like, well, put it together in post. And it just is not, it's not the funniest way to make a movie, you know, like, I don't know. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Yescom wrote this as a straight comedy for Amazon Prime, and this is exactly adapted from the page, and he's to blame. I'm not sure. But Jackpot, I think, is a bit of a miss, bit less of a jackpot, as it were. Any other thoughts or recommendations, Andy?
I think Simu Liu is not in this enough, for as much as he's only kind of in the last third, and it's a bit disappointing because, again, he did all his own, like, stunts and stuff in Shang-Chi, Legend of the Ten Rings, so, like, he could do it. I was expecting a lot more from him because it's like, you have a martial artist guy here and you didn't use him. Like, why would you do that?
Yeah, it's true. He is a lot of fun, though, in this movie. And notably, I was thinking watching this, you know, when I saw him in Shang-Chi, he looks so young. And the next time I see him in Shang-Chi, he's going to have wrinkles and they're going to have to CGI him out. It'll have been 20 years since the last movie. Like, crazy. Anyway, any other thoughts or recommendations?
No, I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend I was about to say Bridesmaids. Would you recommend Jackpot?
I'm going to say pass on this. It was a struggle for me to get through. It's not very funny. You got some decent action scenes. There's a couple of good jokes. Maybe put it on while you're doing laundry or washing dishes, something like that. I was really bored through it. I had to watch it in two sittings. It's too long. It needed to be 90 minutes at most, and it's about 105, 110. So I'm going to say pass.
Yeah, same. Pass. Keep scrolling. You're going to open up Amazon Prime and Jackpot's going to be there. Just move on. Go look for something else. It's fine, but it doesn't have any, like, there's not even, like, any real hidden gems to tell you to come watch it for, you know? Like, I can't even recommend it as like, an offbeat comedy that's got heart, kid. Like, nah, man. It just feels as soulless as its premise, right? Like, it just doesn't, I don't know, it doesn't hit. doesn't do it for me. I would say pass on Jackpot. You're not missing anything. If you want a good Cena performance, like, go check out Peacemaker, right, on Max. Like, he's incredible. If you want a good Simu Liu performance, like, go check out Shang-Chi, or even in Barbie, he's a lot of fun. If you want a good Awkwafina performance, like, go check out The Farewell. She's incredible. God, I wish she'd do more drama. Jackpot is like a bad day for all of these people. Like, it just doesn't work for any of them. It'll make its money on Amazon. Everybody over there will have a great time. Whatever. Like, just let Jackpot go. They're not going to be hurting for your one view. You know what I mean? Like, you're fine. God, that's our episode, Andy. Episode 264. What are we watching next week?
So we're back on August 27th with The Crow, which is the remake of the, I think 1993-1994 movie of the same name, starring Bill Skarsgård and FKA Twigs. We're gonna be looking at that. We don't really know what to think about this. Doesn't look great, but it is the big release that, of course, is about a couple who are killed by mob people. He comes back to life to exact vengeance, and it's based on a comic book, I believe. And we are going to take the plunge and watch Horizon, An American Saga, Part 1, yay, which is now will be streaming on Max by the end of the week. All 3 hours of it. So we are going to go down this road, which means we're going to have to watch Part 2 at some point as well. But that's what we're going to be watching. Also, in case you're interested, Blink Twice, the horror movie with Channing Tatum, comes out this Friday as well. We're going to be skipping that, but that is out in theaters. And looking forward to September, it's getting real dry. There is not a lot coming out, but some things to look forward to in the coming weeks are Beetlejuice, The Substance, September 20th, which we mentioned the trailer before, and Megalopolis, Francis Ford Coppola's big magnum opus possible disaster at the end of the month, September 27th. But The Crow and Horizon, An American Saga, Part 1 for next week.
Big hopes for The Crow. Fingers crossed for just like good goth horror action. You know what I mean? Like, I haven't seen good goth horror action in a minute in the theater. Like, could be big, could be fun, could be gruesome. As for Horizon, I really want to give it a chance. I do. Like, I really want to try to sit down and watch it good on my big screen, like in 4K if I can get it. I'm excited it's coming to Max. It's exactly what I was talking about watching it. I will not commit to watching Part 2 or Part 3 or Part 4 for sure. If Part 1 is a bomb, I'm not coming back. But from what it's worth, I've heard people say that it's redemptive and that there's good stuff and it's good setup because you know it's part of a big epic thing. Like, maybe. And hey, it's from Costner, guy that dances with wolves. Could be heat. Anyway, if you want to see what we think of The Crow next week or Horizon, or you want to talk about what we've done this week, you just want to get in the mix, get involved with the show, get involved with your boys here at Offscript. Best thing you can do is just subscribe to Offscript Film Review, wherever you are listening to or watching or consuming this content. If you're on YouTube, where we're uploading individual reviews and shorts every week, big things going on YouTube. You can subscribe to us there, follow, like, channel, ring the notification bell, keywords, buzz, hot topics. You can check us out on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, all the usual social media places. You can like and follow us there, of course. Big help if you do. For our audio listeners out there, what are we on? Spotify, Google Play, iHeartMedia, iTunes, of course. You can follow us there as well and leave a rating and review if you have the means. We'd love it. Just scroll down or scroll up. I'm not sure which platform you're on, but we appreciate you listening, and we'd love for you to get involved if you can. You can check out our website, offscriptfilmreview.com. You can leave us correspondence directly at mail@offscriptfilmreview.com. My God, episode 264 in the bag from all of us at Offscript, the home of Bolt Cinema. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.